Carnival is here. Today, we're going to test your knowledge about its history. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This year marks the 35th anniversary of Carnival in Miami. It's a tradition that spans the Caribbean and other parts of Latin America. It's known for its lavish and sensual costumes, its steel pan beats, and lots of dancing. It also has a dark and unique history, and our reporter, Nadege Green, will help us learn about it. And talking about Caribbean traditions, we're going to a traveling exhibit of Caribbean culinary delights. We're going to learn how rice, beans, and chicken are prepared differently across the island nations, and what those foods mean when they represent our Caribbean cultures. Also, some malls continue to thrive. Others are failing and shuttering. What should happen to the space? There's a pitch to turn part of a South Florida mall into an arena. We'll learn more about the idea today. All of that coming up on Sundial. First, the news. And welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Tens of thousands of people from around the world, around the region, will be traveling to Miami this weekend for the Carnival celebration. The yearly event, steeped in Caribbean tradition, is a huge boom for local businesses. It features beautiful costumes, live music, and of course, delicious food. Carnival's history dates back hundreds of years and is connected to slavery in the Caribbean. WLRN reporter Nadege Green joins us now to discuss some of that history and, of course, the celebration for the weekend. Nadege, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to this. What does Carnival mean to you?
So Carnival is a big celebration across the Caribbean. I mean, in most parts of the Caribbean, Carnival is tied to Lent season. So Carnival season kicks off around February. And it really has become something that's celebrated year round. So people who do the Carnival circuit will start like carnival hopping in February, and they'll go to all the islands where there are carnivals. So they'll hit up Barbuda, they'll go to Jamaica, they'll go to Trinidad and Tobago, arguably the biggest carnival. You know, you go to Haiti, you go to Antigua, St. Vincent, like you hit up all the islands, and it's just very much rooted in Caribbean culture.
And so this is the 35th anniversary of Miami Carnival.
Yes.
Right? Do you recall your first one? Your first carnival?
That's probably a preteen. Preteen. But yeah, it's just one of those things that you do year round. It's like a big, it's like just like, you know, Calle Ocho is like a big celebration here. You go on Southwest A Street. I also go to Calle Ocho regularly and have been going to that since I was like an itty bitty child here in Miami. But it's like a huge street celebration. Like it is that and then some, right? But it's this coming together of community. It is celebration. It's music. It's artistry. It's all of these things.
Remind us, what is a fête?
So a fête, it just means...
Because you'll hear the word during Carnival.
Yes, a fête just means party. Okay. It's party. So you have the main events of Carnival, which normally is Juve, the day before Carnival, which is this big daybreak. Even before the sun rises, that there's this big coming together. There's a big party before a sunrise. And then that leads into Carnival. But leading up to Carnival, you have all of these fêtes, right? So all of these parties getting ready for Carnival season. So here in Miami, for example, you have probably easily over 50 fêtes planned from Palm Beach County to Miami. I think there's even a cruise leaving from Key West around Carnival. So this is just soca, it's calypso, it's, you know, Haitian artists, it's compa. You know, we are the backyard of the Caribbean. So you really get... If you don't have time to like carnival hop to all the islands, you kind of get a taste of all the islands here
because we're
such a blend of the Caribbean. And so you have, you know, the Jamaican contingent, you have Haitians, you have Trinidadians, you know, you have.
And you said the biggest one is in Trinidad and Tobago. That's really where it originates. Or at least I was trying to do the research to figure out where did it start?
Trinidad is absolutely considered, you know, the mother of Carnival. And, you know, when you look at like the history of carnivals across the Caribbean, it is very much tied to the emancipation of enslaved people. This idea around, you know, Europeans coming into the Caribbean, colonizing, right, and bringing in, you know, the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, which absolutely touched, you know, all of the Caribbean as well as the United States. And so you had these European masqueraders who would have these elaborate balls, right, that enslaved people could not participate in. And so around emancipation, you had this uprising within the Caribbean where they would mock, you know, their former slave masters through this art of carnival, through masquerading, through you know, the music. And really, it was an act of resistance, right? It was an act of resistance and resilience, right? That we are still here and we can celebrate. And so, resistance is very much a part of Carnival, but so is joy.
You know, it was interesting. I mean, again, just trying to find some of the history and going through is that my understanding, I mean, yeah, the slave owners would hold these big parties and they were mocking their slaves. They were, you know, in the way they dressed and partied. And so kind of interesting that the slaves would then turn around. They were mocking their slave owners in the celebration.
But within, you know, African tradition, right, you always had celebrations that were probably as equal to what you saw, you know, with European carnivals. But the thing with enslavement, right, is taking away from, you have literally taken a person and you have ascribed to them this idea that you are not even human, right, that you are property. And so the celebrations that were rooted in Africanness were not able to be celebrated because you were not even considered a being, right? You were just property. And so those celebrations could not happen out in the open, even though we've always had culture, right? We've always had our roots and celebrations, but that was taken from you. And not necessarily taken, because I will say that the culture and the tradition, it survived, but it could not be displayed openly. And so part of Carnival was this celebration and this resilience of being able to celebrate openly, right, after the emancipation of enslaved people across the Caribbean.
Do you think people still understand that history? I mean, it's a big party, but do they get where it comes from?
I definitely think if you're of Caribbean descent, you know the history of Carnival and where that comes from. Certainly, if you're just, you know, walking around Miami this weekend, Columbus Day weekend, and you see the revelry, you see folks partying, you might think it's just a big party. But if you are of Caribbean descent or if you're, you know, a Carnival lover, there are people who this is what they do, right? They love Carnival. I think you know some of the history because it's very much a part of it. I mean, even in Haiti, for example, Carnival isn't just fun. Like in all parts of the Caribbean, you'll have different types of music that comes with Carnival. And so artists will touch on different themes and topics. And some of it is just pure fun. Some of it is about unity. Some of it is about resistance, about corruption. So when you listen to Carnival music, that music has a message. Or when you look at the mass bands, the masquerade bands of Carnival, they typically have a theme as well. Again, that theme could be anything from flowers to something political, right? On overthrowing the government or making a statement about government. And so Carnival has a message behind it as well, if you care to look for it, or it could just be fun.
I was looking at the lineup for some of the performers coming, especially for Sunday. And I know the Bahamas is going to be kind of front and center for a lot of people because of Dorian. So that will be probably one of the big things we'll hear. Again, talking with WLRN reporter Nadege Green, the 35th anniversary of Miami Carnival is this week. It ends on Sunday. That's the last day. Many fetes, many parties, as I've been told. And of course, the big one or at the end is the Fair Expo Center on Southwest 24th Street. By the way, Nadege had a great story this week that aired on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, looking at Miami Carnival, and you can find that story and check it out at WLRN.org. Now, in your story, Nadege, you bring up lots of people come. They're expecting 45,000 to 50,000 people. A good portion of them are coming from out of town, out of the country. Do we get a good number of folks from the Caribbean? They have their own carnival. Do they come here to celebrate it here?
Miami Carnival is big in the carnival circuit. This is considered one of the biggest carnivals before the start of carnival season. Again, there are a few smaller ones that come after Miami Carnival, but this is a big one. So the Greater Miami Visitors Bureau, they did a study looking at carnival, and they found that about a third of the folks who come to Miami Carnival are out-of-towners. So you have folks who are flying in from New York and Georgia, you know, domestically, but internationally, the two biggest markets for Miami Carnival is Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaica. And it's such a big deal that this year, I believe it's Trinidad's TV, their TV network will actually be live streaming Miami Carnival in Trinidad, right? So they'll be, if you couldn't come, if you're in Trinidad, you can watch Miami Carnival in real time. So there's definitely a lot of interest. And of course, with that means, you know, a lot of tourism. This is free marketing for Miami and really cultural tourism, right, is what you're seeing here as well.
And one of the things that you point out in your story is, again, because
Miami and Broward, Miami and Broward are, I mean, the, for example, Juvet is happening at in Broward. Like, so you have all these parties that are really like, this is a regional effect, right? So you have things happening in some very little things happening in Palm Beach County, but most of it is concentrated in Broward and Miami-Dade counties. And in fact, the collective that puts on Miami Carnival, it's really Miami Broward one, you know, committee, because they know that you have that cross-section of folks coming from Miami to Broward, and Broward has a very large Caribbean population, and so you're seeing a lot happening between the two counties for leading up to Carnival.
And that's big business, as you pointed out in the story. This is a great opportunity for a lot of people. There was one story that you talked about, and I want to make sure, Lila or Lila?
Lila.
Lila Nicole. Tell me a little bit about her.
So Lila Nicole is a Miami-based swimwear designer, and she designs for Carnival. She designs Carnival in Trinidad and Tobago. She designs for Carnival in Jamaica, and this is actually her first year designing for Miami Carnival. But, you know, the masquerade bands are huge during Carnival, right? I mean, in some carnivals, one mass band could be hundreds of people. And these are all costumes. Someone gets paid to design those costumes. And so she is one of the designers.
This is a cut from your story.
Carnival has become all year round for me lately. Average costume can cost anywhere from $350 and up, but it includes the experience. So you get a costume, you get the DJs, the bands, the open bar.
$350 and up.
And that's on the lower end. You can easily drop $1,000 on just the Carnival costume. And that's just the costume, right? Your shoes, right? If you're going to have them bedazzled or, you know, customized, that's another cost. If you, you know, your stockings are another cost. Your makeup could be like $100 just to get Carnival makeup done, because it is not just regular makeup. It's elaborate makeup that matches your costume, bedazzling. It is sparkles. It can be like special effects. So there's a lot of work that goes into the Carnival look, and a lot of money too.
I love the pictures that go with your story. Some of the costumes that they were, first of all, just the colors. I love the big feathers, the big headdresses. You know, there's such a big part of it. By the way, did I hear you're making a costume?
I am not making a costume.
I thought I heard that you were going to make a costume.
I am not that talented. I'll have a situation, but I'm not making a costume.
All right. Well, maybe at some point you'll post that up on social media so we'll be able to see that. Do we have a sense of, though, how much money is generated during Miami Carnival?
So this year, the organizers say they're actually going to do the hard money impact study, because last year, the numbers that they had were like how many people come here. And obviously, you can deduce from that if you have 45,000 people coming, a third of them are from out of town. That means they're staying in hotels, they're renting cars, they're, you know, eating out in the restaurants here. But this year, they're following up with a harder study to get those hard numbers, but I imagine it's in the millions of dollars.
You grew up here. One of the things I was interested in is, you know, we talk about the history again, coming back to its origins and what Carnival really stands for. Is that taught in schools? Locally?
Our schools don't really teach history that well in any kind of thoughtful way. So no. I mean, we don't even learn local history, let alone Caribbean history. So
I mean, yeah, I wonder too with this, this is the 400th anniversary of the slave trade in the United States. And I wonder if maybe during Carnival, we're going to see, you know, maybe some of the themes of that, you know, playing out, not just talking again about
I just want to say that I don't consider it an anniversary, definitely a reflection point.
Thank you.
But this does mark 400 years since we are reflecting on the important date of 1619, which is thought to be considered the start of the U.S. slave trade here. But the transatlantic slave trade, again, touched all parts of the Caribbean as well. So when you talk about, you know, traditions and like what lives on, definitely Carnival is part of that. And you know, it's one of those things. When I think Carnival, it's joy, it's therapy, it's fun. You let your hair down, you have a good time. But it's also for me a moment. It really is resistance, right? That through all of these things that we've been through, right? When you think about the horror of slavery, of the horrors of our ancestors being enslaved people, that somehow, some way, all these years later, those traditions can still live on, right? That because the idea was that these things should have been taken from us, right? That these things would not have lived on through us. And like, you know, a lot was taken, but yet here we are, right? We persist and we celebrate and we resist. And that carnival is very much rooted in that. And I think, you know, that's just very much part of that tradition.
And you know what, that's a very good point. Again, thank you. That thinking about the words that we use sometimes, and that is a better way of saying it. Are you going to be celebrating Carnival?
I will be out in Miami Carnival.
Okay. That's as much as she's going to tell us. WLRN reporter Nadege Green, again, talking about Miami Carnival, celebrating 35 years here in Miami. By the way, again, she has a great story that you can find at WLRN.org. And check out the photos. They are so beautiful. Nadege, thank you so much.
All right.
All right, still to come, we're going to keep our focus on Caribbean traditions and taste some of the spices and delicacies from across the island nations. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Are you a fan of Jamaican patties, Cuban empanadas, or Haitian pate core? Well, get your taste buds ready, Sundialers. You can now take a trip to the islands of Jamaica, Haiti, Barbados, Trinidad, the Dominican Republic, and the Bahamas without leaving your home. The traveling exhibition Caribbean Culinary Museum takes attendees through the culinary history of the Caribbean, spices and all. Joining us to talk about Caribbean food and the exhibition is Hugh A. Sinclair. He goes by Chef Irie on the Caribbean cooking series Taste the Islands. Chef Irie, great to have you.
Why, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
This is great to have you here. Also joining us is Kaleeb Thompson. She's the creative director at Island Syndicate and the lead curator of this exhibition. Again, a traveling exhibition. Kaleeb, great to have you back. It's been a while.
Thank you so much. And the executive producer of Taste the Islands with Chef Irie.
Thank you very much. And by the way, that exhibition currently on display at Bailey Contemporary Arts in Pompano Beach now through November 9th. By the way, we're live on Facebook, so you can check this out because we're going to be tasting some food if you want to see some of that incredible food for yourself. Chef Irie, I want to start with you. Take me back to your childhood in Jamaica. What's your fondest memory of food?
Wow. So I grew up in a household and in a family that cooks. And I grew up with a mom that was an exceptional cook. She cooked with no recipes. That was an amazing thing. But
what was it? Just recipes handed down?
Yes, recipes handed down. But, you know, just like most older people in the Caribbean islands, you know, they learned how to cook a certain thing because it was handed down, you know, it's taught to them that way. And that's how she cooked. So I was always in the kitchen as a kid. And of course, my favorite time of the year is always Christmas because I get to lick the bowl when you make the cakes, the batter, you know. But foods, I remember my favorite food that she always made was Chinese chop suey, stew peas, made with pigtails, and of course curry goat, and everything else that she made, you know, is awesome. So I think for me growing up as a kid, food was always around. It was always present. My dad was a great cook as well. He was always famous for his cornmeal porridge. You know, you can't grow up in the islands and not have some type of porridge, whether it's cornmeal, oatmeal, hominy, you know, banana porridge. You know, so it was awesome. So food has always been a big part of my life.
Wait, is it true you were an architect?
Yes, so I went to University of Florida.
Okay, before you
graduated,
into...
and and I worked in the field for a few years and decided that I wanted to do something else with my life. So by process of elimination, culinary school became, you know, a viable option. I applied, they accepted me, I was shocked. And I'm here almost 20 years later.
But what was that moment that you decided, like, because come on, that's a big career.
It's a big career move, yeah. And I thought about it for a while and I just remembered, you know, walking into my office just so distinctively and, you know, sitting over the computer looking at drawings and lines and it's like, this is so not for me right now. School is fun. And I just remember I just walked into my boss's office and said, can I have a moment? And he said, yeah, sure. I said, I'm going back to school next week and this is my last week.
Wow.
Total silence. It seemed like 2 hours, which is about 15 seconds. And I said, yeah, that's what's, you know, and
I walked into
school and here, yeah, it was awesome. But the great thing about going into culinary school was that once I started school, I felt that I was there. I belonged.
Yeah.
You know, I think I made the right decision. Because now, you know, I've had the opportunity to be, you know, the host of Tasty Islands. I've traveled, I've cooked for a lot of different people. But food, I realize I'm passionate about it. I'm passionate about talking about it. And I'm more passionate about talking about my Caribbean, you know, and what it has meant for my career and what it means for me as a person.
Yeah. Khalib, how about you? Your fondest memory growing up?
Just eating, because I was never I was never a cook myself. And, you know, I remember as a child, everybody in Jamaica has a housekeeper. And so they always cook. And I was like, one day, I want to try this. And, you know, I forced my way into the kitchen. I forced my way to cooking things. And it wasn't for me. So now I eat Chef Irie's food. And, I produce. And having done the television series together, it was 2 seasons with American Public Television. And having done the television series together, I saw the growth of even Chef Irie and how his approach to food kind of developed. Because when we started working together, I think he was more exploring international food types and what have you, and then kind of digging down into exploring other island cuisines, you know, food. We tailored the show so that we'd have to touch a little bit on foods from Barbados or the Dutch Caribbean or what have you. And in doing that research together, and, you know, I saw how he even got a greater appreciation for food and stuff. And that I watch from the wings.
So, you know, people here, we know, because I'm from Puerto Rico. So right. A lot of people here in South Florida from the Caribbean. And we know that even though we're all so different, and yet we share so much.
Yes.
And so when you think about food, we share food. Mm-hmm. We share a lot of the same food. We just make it differently. Mm-hmm. We have our own way of doing things. What was the challenge, though, putting this exhibition together? Because you have so many island nations that you could bring together.
The ongoing challenge, because as we move it around, we're funded by a grant from the Community Foundation of Broward, and it's a traveling exhibition that moves from one spot or library or performing arts center to another museum. And the challenge has been to get a good mix of artifacts from around the various Caribbean islands. So we have a whole bunch of stuff from Jamaica, because that's where I'm from. And I was able to appropriate things from the family's backyard. The patio.
It's what we do. It's okay. We take right. from each other. It's
yes.
okay.
Yes. So I appropriated from my mother's patio and my grand aunt's and what have you, and then actually started going out and purchasing items that were found or what have you. And then coming back here to South Florida, I would get people coming and saying, oh, let me, you know, I found this in my garage. Or Food for the Poor actually has loaned us some of their Haitian items, even the one of the mud cookies. Do you remember after the earthquake, you'd hear about these mud cookies that people would kind of mix together with bouillon so they would have some kind of nutrition? We have even one of those inside of the exhibition. So so the challenge was kind of trying to balance all of the islands. We're still not there yet, but we do have things representative of multiple countries if you come in and have a look.
I'm talking with Khalib Thompson and Chef Irie. They are talking to us about this traveling exhibition she's talking about. You just heard Caribbean Culinary Museum. It's currently on display at the Bailey Contemporary Arts in Pompano Beach now through November 9th. By the way, Wednesday, October 23rd, starting at 6 p.m., they are going to hold a panel discussion talking about the history of the foods and where they come from. And you can get more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. By the way, we're doing this live right now on Facebook. So if you want to, go to Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We're live now because we're going to be tasting a little bit of food here in just a minute. I wanted to, you know, and I want to hear from both of you. Chef Irie, I'll start with you. Again, you could take one food and everybody in the Caribbean is going to use it, but they're going to do it their way. Let's pick rice.
Yeah.
Rice. It's a staple. It's everywhere.
Yes.
But how do you, like, tell me a little bit about how in your travels, how you see different island nations approach rice.
So rice is eaten almost every day in pretty much all the Caribbean islands, almost with every dish, per se.
I grew up every day with arroz con frijoles, every day.
Dinner. Fun fact, it's the number one starch consumed in the Caribbean.
Yes. So I think the dish most appropriately that you'd want to mention is rice and peas, or peas and rice. Because everybody sort of does it differently. And of course, everybody appropriates the name and take, you know, umbrage if you, you know, step out of pocket. So if you're Bahamian, it's peas and rice. If you're Jamaican, it's rice and peas. All right. And of course, if you're, you know, Haitian, you know, yeah, it's something else.
Yeah.
So, but it's all made differently. The process is sometimes very differently, you know, from the way even Haitians make rice and peas differently from us. I was taught by a friend of mine when I was in culinary school, you know, there's a part where you cook the peas, take the peas out, fry the peas, put it back in, you know, all of that stuff. You know, Jamaicans, we soak the peas. We soak the peas overnight, you know, throw that water away. And then you're cooking peas and you have to have coconut, you have to have scotch butter, you have to have thyme, plus the other seasonings. You know, other countries, you know, add tomato products to the rice. You know, so, but the flavor is very distinctive for every country that you go to. You in Cuba, you rice and chicken, and you know, in where you're from,
Puerto Rico,
you know, the rice dish there is even different. But I think what we bring to these rice dishes and any other dishes is the culture of love, not just culturally, but the culture of love, and the way you spice things are can be spicy. And things can be spiced. And people need to, you know, you have to understand the difference. Spicy.
With the heat.
And spiced. You know, so, you know, the love comes from the spice. You know, from the coriander, from the cumin, from the garlic, from the achiote. You know, you name it. It's going to be in some dish. In some rice dishes, there you go. Anato. And you know, flavoring, coloring.
Yeah, that's with the yellow rice, right? And if I can share one of the things that made me chuckle one day, I was in a Jamaican restaurant and there we have rice and peas where everything is kind of mixed together. The rice takes on the red color of the kidney beans and what have you. And a Latin lady comes in and she goes, "Oh my gosh, you have your rice and your peas in the same container." And I always have my black beans and rice from Pollo Tropical, you know, and I never paid attention to the fact that they were in different containers. And that's how it always is with one community versus another. So just little things like that you notice when you're in an environment like South
Africa. I have to remember that. Depending on where I am, it's either rice and peas or peas and rice.
That's just rice with the peas. And if you're doing cook-up rice, you know, so cook-up rice is basically rice that you're going to add pretty much anything to it.
Right.
Whether that's protein, you know, and, you know, whether it's sawfish, and there's a, you know, we call rice that's made, you can have rice that's very seasoned and without meat or protein, or you can have it with protein, and usually that's going to be codfish, sawfish, you know, bacalao.
Or pillow.
Yeah, or you can add some pig tail to that. You can add some neck bones to that, you know.
Well, you said something earlier, because the one I grew up a lot with arroz con pollo, chicken and rice. That was very big. It was that or black beans and rice. You know what, Khalid, talking about this exhibition, I mean, it's bringing the history, bringing the food. There's a lot going on, and you have a lot of different ways that you give people that experience. Mm-hmm. How do you describe it for anybody who hasn't seen it? You walk us through it. What are we going to experience?
So there's information and there's artifacts, right? So the information is a lot of this stuff that we're talking about. Where did the food and the flavors come from? The Caribbean is the melting pot, or was at one point the melting pot of the world. I think New York has taken us over now. But in terms of genealogy,
we'll debate that. That's okay.
In terms of people being of truly, genuinely mixed backgrounds, you will find people in the Caribbean who are Chinese and they're Jamaican, and they're Middle Eastern and they're Jamaican or Trinidadian. They're Indian and they're, you know.
Well, I mean, this goes back to, I mean, we were talking about this for Carnival.
Right.
It's the fact that the Caribbean, I mean, all of the European nation settlers, they had to come through the Caribbean first.
Correct.
Before they came to the colony. So everything landed here.
Right. And they brought all kinds of people from all over the world, and everybody has mixed. It's not that one community is over here in a pocket. So we've all mixed together, and people brought their culinary traditions with them. So we kind of tell that story in the information side, where the sweet things came from, where the ground provisions like yams and sweet potatoes and those kinds of things that we all eat that you don't have. You say yam in an American, they're talking to you about the orange sweet potato and not what we call a yam. You know, things like plantains and stews and curries and beans, which, you know, when you do start to do your sampling, we have a few different bean configurations there. So we actually have, I don't know if you want me to get into this yet, but we have doubles from Trinidad, which is curried chickpeas inside of some, what is it called? Is chana inside of the...
The doubles? It's basically the curry chickpeas inside of the two
floridos. The roti bread, right. Yeah. I forget the name of the roti breads, but and then we have some rice and peas from Jamaica. So it's two different configurations of peas. But we talk about the backgrounds of where all of these foods came from in terms of the ethnic, you know, lineage of them. And then on the other side, we have this collection of artifacts. So, you know, again, things from all over the Caribbean. I won't get into the details, but it's culinary implements and utensils, the sticks that they use to make roti and the stick that they use to turn cuckoo in Barbados.
And even the different types of pans and pots. Exactly. And places, exactly. Of course.
The Dutch pots, the containers, the yabas that might have come from Africa, like you're seeing a whole bunch of stuff from Europe, from Africa, all over the place.
I hope that at least people will get to smell, because if that's the best part of you have to set. You've got to, if you're not smelling the food, then you're missing out.
If you come on the 23rd, yes. We are going to have some bites available. So that, and then sometimes we'll have a spice table that shows you all of the spice that people can actually pick up and smell. We don't have that in Pompano this time, but
okay. Yeah. All right, spices, I've got to get to this. You brought us a little dish.
Yeah, there's something in there, yeah. And it's funny that I'm looking at what's on the plate for you there, Liz, and I was listening to your program as Nadej was talking about carnival.
Yes.
And carnival is not just about feathers, you know, mass carnival and juve and all that stuff, but carnival is also about the food.
Yes.
And
I did mention the delicious food.
Yeah, the food, you know, so, yes. And of course, you noticed my excitement level went up as I mentioned carnival, you know, but because I'm going to be there this weekend, but that's doubles. And, you know, quintessentially, it's not just something that you eat throughout the course of the day. It's something that you must have after having, you know, indulge in a little libation spree.
Yes.
You know, you need a little pick me up, a little comeback. Oh gosh, boy. You know, so the curry chana or chickpeas, those two lightly, you know, flour dough, that's, you know, yes, there you go. And you just want to unwrap it and, you know, and just bite into it.
Wow.
Yes, because sometimes it can be a little messy, but that's the beauty of eating at doubles, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And it's a doubles.
Not something, not something that you should do while you're on air. I'll just take a little bite, but you know.
There you go.
Usually, when I'm doing a show.
Oh,
but
boy, he go bite into the doubles, people. He go bite into the doubles.
It's delicious, isn't it?
And so, you know, so the doubles, you know, it comes not just with the curry chana. So the condiments that you can add to that is tamarind sauce. You can add pepper sauce, some pepper chutney, tamarind chutney on top of that. So it even enhances the whole flavor of the doubles that you're eating. But and the good thing, so the thing about doubles, you can't just eat one. I'm just saying, and you probably will not just eat one. You will eat about six of them.
I want to finish this one, but you know, I got to finish this show.
Of course.
Afterwards.
Sorry
and
about that.
Now I feel bad that I don't have the right libations to enjoy with this. I just have water, but this is absolutely delicious. For you, you know, real quickly, I wanted to get a sense from you, Chef Irie. Do you have a style? Do chefs have styles? Would you say you have a style? Because you're pretty well traveled. I mean,
yes. Yes, chefs do have style. I think it's the way you plate your food, the way you cook your food. It's interesting when someone can say to me, "Did you if I go to an event?" And I said, "Did you cater?" And I say, "No." And they'll say, "We know." You know, stuff like that. Or just the way you set things up. And over a period of time, you get accustomed to a lot of things using your sort of inventory and the knowledge that you've gained, and you put that into, especially for me now, that cooking Caribbean food is a platform that I like to, you know, to in delve into even more deeply, because we are very deep, our food is very complex, it can be simple, it can be loud, but it's always so good. And yeah. when, you know, Khalid mentioned Chinese, Indian, Mediterranean, European, there's so many qualities to our foods that I think I as a chef need to bring my style of cooking and cuisine to explore how I can tell the rest of the world how great Caribbean food is.
I bet you were a great architect, but you thank you for changing that and becoming a chef. Khalib, I'll finish with you real quickly. Is again that the October 23rd, there's a special event that people can go see. Just remind people.
Yes, we're going to invite everyone to the artist talk that's happening at the Bailey Contemporary Arts in Pompano. We're diving deeper into this discussion of the history of Caribbean food and our ethnic backgrounds and how all of that tells the story of how we come together as a Caribbean community.
And again, this, the Caribbean Culinary Museum, again, a traveling exhibition currently on display at the Bailey Contemporary Arts in Pompano Beach now through November 9th. Find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, we heard from Chef Iree and Khalib Thompson. Guys, thank you so much. And thank you for the taste.
Awesome.
I'm going to finish this after the show. Yeah. And you've got more food out there and people are attacking it. So you might want to, you know.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Can I plug out even real quick?
Okay.
Yeah, it's Food, Wine, and Fete, November 2nd at Virginia Key Beach. Go to eventbrite.com, Food, Wine, and Fete, November 2nd, 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Chef Iree, Vanessa James Media. Boom!
All right, still to come, what should happen to dying malls? There's a pitch for an auditorium inside the Boynton Beach Mall. More on that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Malls and retail stores across the U.S. continue to shutter as more and more Americans are doing their shopping online. As of last year, mall vacancies were at a seven-year high, nearly 10%. Retail giants like Forever 21 and Sears have declared bankruptcy. And these trends are reshaping those malls, leaving city leaders with giant empty spaces to fill. The city of Boynton Beach has an interesting redevelopment proposal for its mall to include a mid-size arena that could host sporting events, political rallies, and more. Frank Cherubino is a columnist for the Palm Beach Post. He joins us now to talk about this story and what should happen to that mall. Frank, great to have you.
Hi, thanks, Louis. It's great to be here.
Where did this idea stem from? This idea of turning, it's not the whole mall, just turning part of the mall into an arena.
Well, you know, city officials are looking at the mall as a you know, as a potential source of revenue, and I've been in the area long enough when I remember when the Boynton Beach Mall was sort of a gleaming new mall back in the 80s, and it was anchored by a Burdines. That tells you how old it was.
Growing in West Palm Beach, grew up in West Palm Beach, I remember the 80s and 90s. Yes, I recall that.
So what happens, it's just like, it's a great metaphor for South Florida because everybody needs a second act. But so the mall was once, you know, this great new mall. And at that time, if you grew up in South Florida, you know that in the mid-80s, Military Trail was sort of the end of the world as far as going west. If you went west of Military Trail, you'd find mostly farms and not condos that there are there now. And sort of the story of Palm Beach County has been this push westward. And as the growth went westward, another mall sprung up in Wellington, which became a very upscale community. And the mall at Wellington Green was sort of pushing, you know, the people who lived between the Boynton Beach Mall and the mall in Wellington Green sort of went to the newer mall, just like anything else. If you got a new movie theater in your area, you try that out because you've gone to the old one many times. And so the Boynton Beach Mall sort of, you know, felt the pinch. It's interesting to note, I recently wrote a column about the Wellington Mall is also feeling a pinch. And what they've done is they've converted an empty store into a community library, like a reading room. So people just bring in books and you can just go and hang out there and sit and read a book and take it home with you and bring another book in. And it's an interesting concept. Rather than having an empty store, they have a place where people go into the mall. It's a perfect thing for husbands who really don't want to shop, you know, and the wives are shopping. And you can sit in and they have armchairs and, you know, you can go and get a cup of coffee next door. And
one of the bigger stores? Is that what they turned into?
Well, it's actually, when I went there, it was a I was expecting it to be at one store. It's basically, it's a moving target. So there'll be a vacancy. They'll put it in there, and then somebody will rent that space out, and then they'll move it to another vacancy. So it just bounces around the mall, but it's like a steady thing. It's an interesting idea.
What does the Boynton Beach Mall look like today?
The Boynton Beach, I'm going to confess to you that I live in Boca Raton, so I have no reason to go to the Boynton Beach Mall because I work in West Palm, so I've gone to the Outlet Mall up there quite a bit, and I've gone to the Town Center Mall in Boca. So I haven't really been. The last time I've been to the Boynton Beach Mall was actually to go see a movie there. They have a freestanding building in the lot, and there's a movie. So I just know from what I've read that it's that the mall is sort of falling on somewhat hard times compared to other malls in the area.
So
it kind of makes sense. I mean, you have a big space like that. There are a certain amount of things you can do with that. There used to be a municipal auditorium in West Palm Beach, the leaky teepee, because the roof always leaked and it was shaped like a teepee. Eventually the city realized we have to get rid of this thing because I actually saw a Marilyn Manson concert there. But
I was going to say I graduated high school there. Where did the idea? When did the first inkling of this idea for an arena?
It was just kind of they're spitballing at the city of Boynton Beach, and the mayor just said, well, maybe we should float this idea. That's the other part of the story, is that there is a lot of we have plenty of places out there, but there's always can be one more place for somebody to end up. And I in my column, I just imagined that this would be sort of the real sort of D-list kind of events, the accordion, conventions and things like that.
Yeah. You looked at possible concerts. I mean, some of the things that you were listing.
World Pickleball Championship.
World Pickleball Mahjong Tiles show. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also some presidential rallies. I mean, but here's the thing in Palm Beach County, are there not enough arenas already?
Well, there are plenty. I mean, we have, I shouldn't say arenas. We have like large auditoriums. A lot of the condo communities have just beautiful auditoriums that hold hundreds of people, and so are good for like that kind of event. And then you have the Coral Sky Amphitheater out west. That is a very big arena for traveling national concerts.
So how do city officials feel about this idea? What do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. I think this was just one of those things that was just thrown out there. I don't think they even have a developed plan. I think this is just like let's think of something that can happen with this big piece of land that's in our city and that we'd like to see thrive, and this is just one of the ideas.
And I wonder, from your readers, what have you heard? Do people like the idea, or they have other pitches?
No. The only comments I get are people who complain about things. So there'd just be people who complain about the Boynton Beach Mall. They'd use that as an excuse to say, "Oh, I don't go there now because I don't like it now." It's a very cranky, population here. So it's anytime you write about something, you're just providing a forum for people to complain about it.
I get the sense not much has changed since I grew up in West Palm Beach.
Again, that might be why you left.
Probably
do a show on that.
Many other reasons. I'm talking with Palm Beach Post columnist Frank Cherubino. And again, we're talking about the transformation of the Boynton Beach Mall. There's a plan. There's an idea that's been pitched. Maybe turn part of it into this auditorium, this mid-size arena. What do you think? If you live there, what should happen to the mall? Do you think this is a good idea, or maybe you have another idea? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. And just in general, looking at malls up and down South Florida, some of them are doing well, some of them maybe not so well. What would you like to see that space turned into if you happen to have a mall that's not doing so well in your area? You can also email us, sundial@WLRNnews.org. Frank, I want to switch things over a little bit, transition to another story, this idea of, because it's now becoming very popular in Palm Beach County, power lines. There's a push, been now for some time across the state, to move power lines underground. Is this a good idea? Do people there support that?
It's a good idea aesthetically. And then when people find out how much it costs and the fact that FPL will not pay for it, then it becomes a little bit more controversial. So the first town here that that actually did it was the town of Palm Beach, you know, on the island there. They decided that FPL was planning to do what they call hardening the lines, because after the hurricanes of 2004 and 5, a lot of the wooden poles snapped, and many of them were kind of old and in disrepair. And FPL thought it would be a good investment to build these bigger concrete poles that would be more resistant to the winds and would have fewer power interruptions after a middling hurricane like Category 1 or 2.
And I remember after Irma, this was a big question, especially here in Miami-Dade, this question of putting them underground because it would make them stronger against the hurricanes. But there's still the concern, though, that flooding can cause long-term damage to underground.
Right.
Lines.
So the jury is really out. So it would definitely help for wind. You know, there wouldn't be that hazard of the wind, you know, knocking tree limbs into power lines and bringing them down. That wouldn't be a problem. And for safety after storms, a lot of the issues with safety are people walking around with down power lines and getting hurt. So that would be it. But the flip side of that is if you have a storm where there's a lot of flooding, that those underground lines would then be vulnerable to disruption. And then it's a lot harder figuring out how to repair them. You have to literally dig up a big area and wait for the ground to dry. You could actually have power outages that last longer with buried lines than you would for aerial lines.
So, you come back to this question of cost and the fact that FPL won't pay for it. So how did the town of Palm Beach convince folks? I mean, how do we convince folks? Okay.
Well, it was very tough because they started out thinking, well, everybody's going to kind of go for this because those above ground lines look unsightly. So we'll just have a bond issue. And it was a $90 million a bond issue, and we'll put it to the people, and we'll just we'll pay to bury them ourselves. Well, they started out; it was very popular. Quickly, an opposition in town formed, and they started doing counter, sort of advertising, and it became a very close issue. And out of about 2,600 or so voters, it passed. I'm sorry, 4,200 something voters. It passed by only 60 votes. So there are a lot of people in town that didn't want to spend the money to bury the lines, and it kind of divided. It kind of divided by areas in town. Sort of the condo areas, so the big Oceanside condos to the south were generally against it, while the big, sort of palatial estates to the north were for it.
My understanding, though, that there is a what's called a Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act to help.
That wasn't the issue. So at the time, this was a year before Irma when they took the vote and voted to pay for this bond issue. So then it was like, okay, we're going to do it. And this is a multi-year process. But it turns out the following year, after they had already voted to do it, Irma came by. And because of its significant damage throughout the whole state, Florida became eligible for this Roger T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, which was something from 1988 by a senator from Vermont, who, by the way, the Stafford loan is named after, who said, basically, we should help these communities with disasters, and we'll set up this mechanism where federal money will flow through the states for disasters. So if you qualify as one of these qualifying events for the Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Act, you have basically access to a almost unlimited amount of federal money. So the town of Palm Beach started applying for money through FEMA, which is the federal agency that does it, using the Stafford Disaster Relief. And they got about $10 million in beach renourishment. And then they applied and got a grant There's another aspect of the Stafford program that is a disaster mitigation. And FEMA ended up paying $8.5 million to the town to help them pay to bury the lines. So even though they voted to bury the lines before Irma, and it had kind of nothing to do with or little to do with hurricanes when they did it, it was more aesthetically, they were able to sort of use Irma to get about almost 10% of the funding for it.
Briefly, coming back as we finish up, is coming back to the idea of the mall, is there a conversation coming up with the city on this?
Not that I know of.
All right. We'll keep our eyes on it. Again, what should happen to the Boynton Beach Mall? We'll see. I guess we shall see. We've been talking again with Palm Beach County columnist Frank Cherubino, Palm Beach Post columnist, Frank Cherubino. And again, you can find a link to his piece of what should happen to that mall on our social media, WLRN Sundial. He's got a fun list of ideas on there. Frank, a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Hey, thank you, Lewis. Appreciate it.
And that's our program for this Wednesday, October 9th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, WLRN kicks off its fall pledge drive, which means we're going to bring back some of your favorite Sundial conversations. We're going to look at the reasons behind the Greater Miami Region's traffic problems, the illicit practice of capturing songbirds, and a film that stars a Palm Beach County graduate with Down syndrome. And a reminder, for this month's Sundial Book Club, we are reading Dear Haiti, Love Elaine from the sisters Maika and Maritza Molite. The young adult novel has a lot of fun and powerful stories. You can find us, our Sundial Book Club, on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. And again, you can always find us online, WLRN.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Tell us what you think of the program. Let us know what kind of topics we should be talking about. And if you can't hear us live at 1 p.m. or 8 p.m., find our podcast. We're on iTunes. Just look up Sundial. Subscribe. Listen whenever you want to. And always give us a little bit of a like if you don't mind. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.